This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. For more than 1,000 years, universities have aspired to be the place where human knowledge blooms. At times, they have failed to meet that aspiration. But the very word university contains within it their all-encompassing, ambitious purpose. Universum, the Latin root, of course, meaning all things, all people, the totality of all that exists. But what if universities are no longer such places, no longer open to the totality of all people, all knowledge? What do we all lose, whether or not you've ever stepped foot on a university campus? Well, let's start with Stephen Salida. Listen carefully to how he introduces himself.
I used to be a professor of English and American Indian Studies.
Salida used to be a professor of English and American Indian Studies because he hasn't been able to find a job in academia since 2016. In the fall of 2013, he'd accepted a position at the University of Illinois. He'd signed the contract and was ready to begin his new job.
Late July 2014, I was literally less than 2 weeks away from moving to Illinois. Everything had been arranged with the mover. My child, who was 2 years old at the time, had been enrolled at the on-campus daycare. Everything was ready to go, and suddenly I got an email out of the blue from the chancellor of UIUC informing me that the job offer had been pulled. I had effectively been fired.
More than 420 American scholars have been, quote, targeted for sanction by ideological adversaries since 2015, according to a new study from the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education. Now, given the size of higher education in this country, you might consider 420 to be an insignificantly small number. Or you might consider it deeply troubling that there's a need to track such a number in the first place. Stephen Salida's troubles began, as they now so often do, on social media.
I had taken to Twitter and other forms of social media to condemn Israel's 2014 bombardment of the Gaza Strip.
Israel attacks Gaza from the air and from the sea. 50 targets hit in overnight strikes.
Salida posted hundreds of strongly worded tweets. For example, on July 19th, 2014, he wrote, quote, "You may be too refined to say it, but I'm not. I wish all the West Bank settlers would go missing." Then on July 20th, quote, "At this point, if Netanyahu appeared on TV with a necklace made from the teeth of Palestinian children, would anyone be surprised?"
My comments, very highly critical comments of Israel's behavior, sort of evoked the ire of a lot of pro-Israel elements in and around the University of Illinois and some large money donors who were pro-Israel in orientation pressured the university to rescind the appointment.
For example, Dave Downey, life member of the University of Illinois Foundation Board, said this about Salida in September 2014.
"From what I can see of Mr. Salida, he is an engaging man. He probably is a very smart man, and he probably will do very well. But I don't want him doing it here, representing me and being the face that I have to look at with the kinds of things he has said about other people."
The university's administration hewed to the will of the donors and ended up pulling the job offer. I was stunned, absolutely stunned. First of all, it came out of nowhere, and we're talking about a 2-year hiring process. I had been vetted extremely carefully. I had already resigned my job at Virginia Tech, so it was a bit of a mess. Everybody was in flux. It wasn't just me. The department was in flux. I'd already been assigned courses. I'd already ordered my textbooks and turned in my syllabi. Certainly the university's administration knew that it wasn't going to be a smooth process, although I doubt that they anticipated just what an enormous story it would become.
Salida then went to the American University of Beirut, working as a visiting professor in Lebanon. He was there for 2 years. He says his fellow faculty members chose him to become permanent director of the university's American Studies program, but he claims that decision was revoked by the school's administration in 2016. Salida says that's when the well dried up.
Over the years, I've applied to dozens and dozens of academic jobs, and I've not gotten so much as a screening interview. And people who aren't in academe don't always understand this. It's extremely difficult, after being the source of a public controversy, to land another job. Once you've been marked with a certain reputation, then you know you become all but toxic to search committees. In 2017, realizing that, you know, I needed money, I needed health insurance especially, I decided to become a school bus driver. And I went for training in Northern Virginia and became a school bus driver. And I stayed in that job right until the COVID pandemic hit. And then the pandemic, of course, shut down all school transportation, possibilities. They shut down the schools in general in this region. And so now I'm just writing and doing substitute work as needed as a school bus driver. So that's kind of my life right now. Making the decision to leave academe was, in a lot of ways, heartbreaking. It still is heartbreaking and difficult to me. Just talking about it, I get sad. But it was at the same time a relief in the sense that I did what I felt in the moment was necessary. There have been times where I've been resentful that I've had to go into a different job, in lots of ways a more difficult job, and certainly a job that doesn't come with the same kind of pay and prestige. It took me out of a career that had become a decisive feature of my identity. It changed everything.
Stephen Salida. He's a former tenured associate professor at Virginia Tech and now a school bus driver. So has there been a meaningful decline in academic freedom on American college and university campuses? What do we mean when we say academic freedom in the first place? Well, in spring of last year, a group of scholars felt enough alarm that they created the Academic Freedom Alliance. Their goal is to, quote, defend faculty members' freedom of thought and expression in their work as researchers and writers or in their lives as citizens with established ethical and legal bounds, end quote. Their current membership includes faculty from institutions across the United States, including the University of California, Indiana University, Michigan State, Duke, Baylor, Texas A&M, Harvard, and the University of Washington, and many more. Keith Whittington is a professor of politics at Princeton University and chair of the Academic Freedom Alliance. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So first of all, you know, we tend to start with anecdotes in journalism, and even any collection of anecdotes, you could draw any constellation you want out of them. But is there a significant body of evidence, actual evidence, that shows that there's been a change or a reduction in academic freedom in this country?
Well, it is particularly tricky to get to get good evidence about changes over time. It's hard to even get a good handle on what the situation is right now. As you noted, the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education just issued a report which covers just the last few years, focusing on faculty who have been threatened in their jobs and targeted for termination at American universities. I think we know that that's just the tip of the iceberg. Even over that time period, those are publicly discussed cases you could find in the media. FIRE, through its own work, the AFA, through our work, encounter lots of faculty who are dealing with these more quietly behind the scenes, and their cases never become public. So I think we know that there are hundreds of faculty who are being threatened now, many, many more whose speech is chilled as a consequence of seeing those threats occur. What's much harder to get a handle on even than that is knowing how bad were things 10 years ago, how bad were things 20 years ago. Certainly the sense of many of us is that the situation is worse now than it was not too long ago. And we may be at a crucial turning point where things could get much worse in the not too distant future.
Okay, so let's speak in more specific terms there. I mean, with the Academic Freedom Alliance and its creation, why did you decide to be one of the founders of this? What specifically is, quote unquote, changing, as you're saying, that caused caused the need for such a new alliance?
Well, the case of Illinois actually was, for me, somewhat galvanizing, of recognizing that things I took for granted about the extent to which hiring decisions, for example, would really be in the hands of the faculty. You expect trustees to largely stay out of those decisions. That kind of very public intervention to derail a faculty hiring decision, I found particularly disturbing. It made me focus much more on these issues more generally. And of course, you don't have to look very far then to realize that that case is not unique, that there are other situations where people are being attacked, although that was particularly high profile example of it. And the more you look around, the more of these kind of cases you see. It made me increasingly realize that you really needed to set aside time to focus on this issue. I couldn't continue to take these kinds of freedoms for granted. If I took them for granted, it may well be the case that a few years from now, I wouldn't enjoy them. And likewise, people who follow me in academia might not enjoy the same academic freedoms that I do.
Well, we are talking about academic freedom on American college and university campuses. When we come back, we'll talk more about where the pressures are coming from the left and the right. Which one's worse? Is it all bad? And really, why should people who never even step foot on a college campus care about this issue? We'll talk about that and more. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're talking about the state of academic freedom on American college and university campuses. Has something meaningfully changed when it comes to the spectrum of scholarship that is acceptable on American college campuses? And if you don't go to college, if you don't go to a university, why should you care about this issue? Well, that's what we're talking about today. And we've received some calls about this from listeners already. Here's Ben from Venice Beach, California, who says that professors should be able to speak their minds freely and disagree, just like off campus.
I have my mom and an aunt who are both professors at state schools, and they are afraid to be able to speak their mind and voice their opinion in all aspects. So it, to me, seems like there's a major disconnect between preparing young adults for the real world and kind of coddling them in college.
Keith Whittington joins us. He is the chair of the Academic Freedom Alliance. He's also William Nelson Cromwell Professor of Politics at Princeton and author of Speak Freely, Why Universities Must Defend Free Speech. And Professor Whittington, I hope you'll forgive me, but I'm still trying to sort of draw some meaning out of what seems to be a miasmic feeling right now, right? I'm kind of a data person.
Sure.
There's that fire study we talked about of the 420 dismissals, I guess you could say. But obviously, with the formation of the Academic Freedom Alliance and all the high-profile cases that do make it into the media, I'm still just trying to assess how much things are actually have actually changed on campuses. So let me just ask you, have you felt a narrowing of your academic freedom or a chilling effect of on what you can, what you feel you can say and teach in the classroom?
I personally actually have been pretty well situated relative to this. I'm lucky at being at an institution like Princeton University, which has been good on these issues in general. We have fairly strong policies. We have an administration who is fairly committed to free speech issues. And we enjoy a sizable endowment. And as a consequence of that, Princeton can be more resistant to these kinds of outside pressures that other universities find themselves faced with when people demand that faculty be silenced or are fired. Lots of their faculty are not as well situated as I am. They are not tenured, for example. And so one of the areas where, and often without much attention, faculty frequently find themselves being suppressed or faculty who are in very short-term teaching positions. They have class by class contracts, semester by semester, year by year contracts, not on the tenure track, not with long-term protections of tenure. When there are complaints about those faculty or there are concerns about the speech of those faculty, universities can simply cut them loose, don't even have to offer an explanation as to why it is they're not being given a new class to teach the next semester. And so a lot of faculty are in those situations. A lot of faculty are in situations where they're at universities that don't have a lot of resources. And so powerful donors or alumni come to those universities and say, this professor is problematic. We think you would be well advised to get rid of them. Some universities cave in to that kind of pressure. It's important for people who are in my situation to be willing to stand up on behalf of those people who are more vulnerable.
So you just said donors and alumni. I mean, are they the primary forces here when a university decides to act on a complaint? Because a lot of the high heart rate coverage in the media has to do with students complaining or rallying against faculty.
Right. Well, one of the things I find so disturbing about our current situation is, unfortunately, there's not just one group that's attacking academic freedom. We actually see attacks from a lot of different directions. So one of the traditional things that faculty have long been concerned about is pressure from donors and alumni. The American Association of University Professors, another faculty organization that formed in the early 20th century, in order to advance principles of academic freedom in the United States, was particularly concerned with the influence of powerful donors and alumni on university campuses. And in the early 20th century, they had an extraordinary influence in being able to fire faculty. And it's been a constant struggle to try to reduce that influence and try to insulate faculty from those pressures. But unfortunately, it's also true that the media and politicians have gone after faculty. We've seen lots of examples of students going after faculty on campuses. And with petition campaigns calling for their universities to fire professors. And sometimes universities are good at standing up to these pressures, whether they're coming from on campus or off campus. But sometimes universities are not very good and they are inclined to cave in, whether it's students making these demands or donors making these demands.
So what exactly does that mean is changing on college campuses? I mean, I presume that you decided to become part of the Academic Freedom Alliance because you're concerned with the effect that, I mean, is there a narrowing of intellectual discourse on college campuses as a result of these varying pressures, which it seems like you're describing those pressures have increased dramatically recently?
Yeah, I think there really is a narrowing of the range of ideas and discussions that can go on college campuses. That's not to say everybody is affected. It's not to say some people aren't willing to speak out. But you see an awful lot of faculty who find themselves much more cautious about what it is they're willing to do, what it is they're willing to write about, how they teach their classes. I've talked to lots of professors who've said that they've dropped material from their teaching. They've dropped topics and subject matter from their teaching simply because it's too controversial. It's too likely to get them in hot water with students, with administrators, with outsiders. And so it's just safer, easier to simply drop that material and not talk about it. People are affected in terms of what kind of research projects they take on and how they pursue them out of concern about what kind of backlash they might get as a consequence of their scholarship. People react in various ways. And of course, part of what's really disturbing about these kinds of attacks is not only about the particular individuals who are threatened with being fired or dragged through lengthy investigations, but it's the much, much larger number of faculty who look at those examples and say, I don't want to be that person. I don't want to have to go through a similar ordeal. So how can I avoid the possibility that I might cause offense to anyone and potentially be subjected to that? Mm. And that just makes academia much less interesting place. It makes the scholarship not as good. It makes the teaching not as good. Universities aren't accomplishing what they're supposed to be accomplishing if we're afraid to grapple with difficult ideas.
Yeah. You know, I started this hour with an admittedly idealized definition of what universities are, right?
Sure.
This, you know, it's supposed to be the place where the full expanse of human knowledge is welcomed and nurtured. I'd like to believe that. But also, factually speaking, I mean, they've almost actually never been that way, right? Because universities have a long history of barring different groups of people, barring students of color, barring women. So they're, you know, for much of the life of many universities, they were pretty homogeneous places. So, I mean, if there's, that's a different kind of narrowing of thought and experience. So, I mean, how is this, what's going on, any different now?
Well, it's certainly different in some of the details. It's different in some of the people being targeted, but there's a lot of overlap. One reason why I find it difficult to talk about how much of things have changed is partially lack of data and hard to know what the transformations look like exactly and how much worse the situation now than it once was. But it's also true that I'm very resistant to narratives that say, well, there was a golden age. There was some moment in time in which universities fully met the ideal. There wasn't such a moment in time. We've always struggled with these kinds of issues. And some of that is exactly on the dimensions you just emphasized of who is allowed into the university, who is allowed to participate in these conversations, what kinds of voices, what kinds of perspectives do we embrace and bring in. But some of it's also about what kinds of protections for free speech on college campuses do we provide, and are we willing to resist pressure when people come under threat? Universities have always struggled with those things, and that struggle is going to be ongoing and continue. But the goal is to come close to that ideal. How do we bring more people into academia and allow them to explore a wide range of ideas?
Well, we are talking today with Keith Whittington. He is the William Nelson Cromwell Professor of Politics at Princeton University, author of Speak Freely, Why Universities Must Defend Free Speech. And he's also chair of the newly formed or relatively newly formed Academic Freedom Alliance. Now, Whittington's co-founder, Professor Donna Hughes of the University of Rhode Island, is no stranger to controversy herself. We actually requested an interview with Professor Hughes, but she was unable to join us today. But we are speaking with Professor Whittington. But I do want to note that Professor Donna Hughes is a world-renowned expert in sexual exploitation and human trafficking. And as a result, her work has often drawn sharp criticism. As I said, she's no stranger to controversy. In 2004, some of her research was in fact taken down from the University of Rhode Island website following the threat of legal action from a British law firm. I'm sure you're familiar with that case, Professor Whittington. At the time, the ACLU called for the university to vigorously defend Hughes, pointing to the, quote, great cost to the university when it comes to the mere threat, when it allows, I should say, the mere threat of an action to result in the removal of speech. Well, Professor Hughes is again at the center of controversy because in February of this year, she wrote an article in 4W, a fourth wave feminist magazine, where she drew similarities between what she called irrational thinking on the political right and the left. She criticized the trans rights movement, writing, quote, "These fantasies from QAnon on the right to trans-sex gender identity ideology on the left fly in the face of rationality and truth," end quote. While trans activists and fellow faculty were outraged and called for Hughes's dismissal, the University of Rhode Island issued a statement where it said, "Professors have the general right to academic freedom in their teaching and scholarship. These rights are not boundless, however, and URI noted that faculty have, quote, obligations to the university students and the university community." Well, Emma Jericho is a member of that community. She is a senior at the University of Rhode Island. And in March, she started a change.org petition demanding Professor Hughes's removal.
It made a lot of people afraid. Because this kind of rhetoric just leads to actions. I mean, transgender people are targeted and killed just because they are transgender. And so when someone like a professor who's tenured is pushing that it's scientific fact that, you know, they don't exist, that just leads to action that's just not safe for them.
Jericho says she understands the need for diverse viewpoints on campus, but she believes certain scholarship can be a threat to student safety.
You know, science is definitely a space to be creative, and a lot of our breakthroughs are made because someone decided to go against the grain. But in this circumstance, if we have our faculty who are, you know, like supposed to be experts in their field, hold PhDs, and are submitting academic work that's been proven false by a lot of other academics, and at the end of the day is creating an unsafe space for our students, I think that is where the line is drawn when it comes to academic freedom.
And finally, she says, there's an unacceptable double standard at play.
I'm a student athlete, and so I have to be careful of my actions and what I do outside of the university, because at the end of the day, I represent URI. And if I do something that goes against our code of conduct, even if it's not on campus, I could still face repercussions for that. And I think our faculty should be held to the same standard.
That's Emma Jericho, a senior at the University of Rhode Island. Keith Whittington, respond to what she's saying there, that she and many other students and donors and alumni, as you've pointed out, believe there actually should be a line beyond which it is not only not in service of the academic exploration of a university community, but actually harmful to it. What's your response to that?
Well, for sure, there are some lines about what the scope of academic freedom looks like, and universities have some responsibility to actually patrol those lines and to sanction faculty when appropriate. The challenge is to try to educate people as to what the scope of those protections of academic freedom is, and it certainly can't simply be limited by what we might characterize as what's in the best interest of the university, for example. And quite a few universities have tried to adopt that kind of language in order to identify where the lines are. That's exactly the kind of standard that in the 19th century and early 20th century led universities to say, well, we ought to fire faculty, for example, that cost us donor dollars. We ought to fire faculty when they offend students who threaten not to continue to want to come to school, or maybe future students won't want to come to school and pay tuition dollars to the school. That could be extremely limiting then as a consequence of the range of ideas that can be reasonably discussed on campus. At the same time, of course, faculty have a responsibility in the classroom not to be embarked on indoctrination efforts. They have a responsibility in the classroom to stick to the subject matter they're supposed to be teaching. And while that subject matter may well be controversial and difficult, and they can express controversial ideas relating to that subject, you don't expect, for example, your engineering professor to spend their class period talking about the last presidential election and what he thinks about the presidential candidates. There's a limit in scope as to what the nature of the discussions ought to be in that classroom environment. Likewise, faculty shouldn't harass or threaten individual students. And if you find evidence that faculty are doing that or faculty are treating individual students unfairly, they can and should be disciplined for engaging in those kinds of activities. But all that's quite different than saying professors shouldn't be allowed to explore certain kinds of ideas. They shouldn't be allowed to have certain kinds of opinions because we find those troubling or problematic or concerning. That's exactly what it is. In fact, you want professors to be willing and able to explore difficult and controversial ideas that some people, in fact, are going to find offensive and disturbing.
Well, we're talking about the state of academic freedom on American college campuses. Hop over to social media, Twitter and Facebook. We're at On Point Radio. And let us know what you think. Is there a narrowing of the mind going on American college campuses? What is driving that? What are the consequences of that? Why should we care as a country? Let us know. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Seen. Listen and follow Last Seen wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're talking about the state of academic freedom on American college campuses and why the nation should care. I'm joined by Keith Whittington. He's the Cromwell Professor of Politics at Princeton and author of Speak Freely, Why Universities Must Defend Free Speech. He's also chair of the Academic Freedom Alliance, an alliance formed by faculty members from across the country. Professor Whittington, we did get quite a few calls from listeners sharing their experiences, and here's another one. This is Andy McCollum. He's a former biology professor from Mount Vernon, Iowa, and he says he taught there for 21 years, but he won't name the college specifically because he signed a non-disclosure agreement in a severance settlement when he left the college, or says he feels like he was forced to leave the college, and he says the fallout began— this is what he told us in his call, during an off-campus week-long camping trip.
During this trip, I answered a female student's question related to menstruation one day. And I gave an honest answer that involved what I thought was a teachable moment in which we could apply statistics to the real world. That is, what was the probability of a given number of female students menstruating during a given week? The question may seem odd, but it was directly related to the question from the student, and I was a biology professor teaching a biology class. After returning to campus, another faculty member overheard students discussing this event and decided that I had sexually harassed my students. I was subsequently called into a meeting with my dean and my female department chairperson. Despite my explaining that I was answering a direct question about biology in a way that made students think, the event was twisted by my own department chair into me having singled out students to ask them questions about their menstruation, which I never did. I was subsequently told not to discuss anything that was not directly related to the course that I was teaching at the time. The suggestion was that I should limit my conversation with students not only in class, but also outside of class time.
And Andy McCollum also said that he later left the college after what he says are other misinterpretations of his actions with students, which led the dean to say that he had a pattern of bad behavior. So that's a story from an On Point caller. But Professor Whittington, I'm wondering, we're going to talk about pressures from the right here in a second, but sure. In terms of these sort of changing social norms, it mm-hmm. is really what's going on is just, I don't know, baby boomer faculty, even Gen X faculty. I'm going to quote Michelle Goldberg in the New York Times here, where she said it's just what it really is just discomfort with losing control over newly defined intellectual and social norms here, that there isn't actually a problem. It's just, you know, it's hard to let go of power and influence.
Well, there's no question that there's certainly some generational divides on college campuses. Students have different sensibilities than faculty. And sometimes that's quite dramatic, even if we might think, for example, both students and faculty are largely on the political left, which tends to be true. On average, the faculty on university campuses tend to lean left, and so does the student body. And yet, nonetheless, there are specific things they're likely to disagree about. Specific ideas, language that students might well find discomforting or offensive that faculty don't. But unfortunately, this is a very long story. This has always been true. There are divides between faculty and students about how to think about particular issues, about particular ideas, particular language, and what students find discomforting or offensive and what they don't. And the goal of academic freedom, in part, is precisely to insulate faculty to be able to explore ideas without allowing students to march into a dean's office and say, this person needs to be fired because I found their particular ideas offensive. That part of what university faculty are supposed to be doing is talking about difficult and offensive ideas. And so there is a question of power, ultimately, and ultimately the fate of universities turn a bit on to what degree should we allow students to be running the decisions about what the scope of ideas are that can be talked about on campus, and to what degree should it be faculty. And the core of academic freedom commitments has always been, at the end of the day, we want the faculty making those choices, not the student body.
Mm. Well, I mean, we could talk about social pressures, changing intellectual norms. We could talk about the financial pressures that come from major donors. But we can't ignore the fact that college campuses, in their own way, are microcosms of the country as a whole, right? And we are undergoing this period, I would say, of profound ideological hardening. And so couldn't it almost be a greater threat when we see, for example, states passing laws that seek to ban what can be taught on university campuses? We have that happening in the United States. There are several states that have just, you know, passed legislation that say, for example, critical race theory can't be taught university campuses, at least in their boundaries. So when an institution and the faculty working for it perhaps are facing the power of the state, is that not more worrisome?
It is itself very worrisome. And so it is true, I think, when you focus on what students complain about on campuses and the kind of faculty they go after and particular controversies that arise, it's often coming from the political left, where students are raising objections to speech that they find too conservative in various ways. When you see these kind of legislative threats to college campuses or politicians going after college campuses, it's often coming from the political right. And the critical race theory example is one of those where some state legislatures have considered and some have even adopted what are extraordinary sloppy pieces of legislation that pose real problems for how universities operate. And it's predictable that university administrators will often overreact to that legislation. So we've already seen examples of this where administrators worried about funding, worried about what the effects of this legislation might look like, take very drastic measures to curtail what kinds of talks are allowed on campus, curtail what kinds of classes are being taught on campus in order to try to avoid running afoul of those kinds of political pressures. And obviously the result is a campus that's more conformist, a campus in which there's an orthodoxy, in this case, an orthodoxy being imposed by politicians. And at the end of the day, that's not what you want your universities to be.
Do you know what we haven't talked about? We haven't yet talked about the responsibility of these institutions themselves. Because, you know, when it comes to the actual moment of decision-making, all the power lies in the hands of deans, of college presidents, right? And they're the ones, if a student comes to them with a complaint or a politician says, you can't teach X, there's a group of people on every college campus who makes the decision. And are we seeing enough courage from them? I'm seriously asking.
No, not even close.
Because you've said basically 'twas ever thus in a certain way, but in the past, a student might have been laughed out of the dean's office. I mean, no offense, but they might have been laughed out of the dean's office. Right. Or that same college president might have shown up in the state legislature to testify in defense of the intellectual freedom on her college campus. I mean, is that not happening?
I wish it was happening. That's absolutely what ought to happen, right? That a student, I don't necessarily blame students who have complaints. I don't necessarily blame them for starting petitions to say we don't like what a particular professor is doing. Students don't always have a deep appreciation for the scope of these freedoms. And of course, they get caught up in these particular controversies like everybody else does. I don't necessarily blame donors or politicians for wanting to exert pressure on these institutions either. At the end of the day, the people who deserve the most blame are the university administrators. They should understand what the boundaries of academic freedom are. They should understand the responsibility of their position is exactly to stand up to these kinds of pressures and push back and defend the faculty in the face of these kinds of pressures, whether they're coming from students or politicians or donors. And university presidents and administrators more generally often are not very good at that. Often instead they will cave in. It is easier for them to do so. Sometimes they don't are not very committed themselves to these principles of academic freedom. They find it easier to simply throw the faculty member under the bus rather than actually stand up in defense of these core things that universities ought to be about. And they bear the lion's share of the blame. If I thought that these kinds of petitions, these kinds of emails from donors would simply be ignored by university presidents, I'd be much happier and would feel like problem solved. But unfortunately, that's not where we are.
Now, I know I'm going to eventually get emails and letters from college administrators after this because maybe they'll feel like we're unfairly beating up on them. So I welcome that feedback. But, you know, in some cases, these are individuals who are being paid hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars on some of these college campuses. So I wonder, you know, what really is preventing more universities, more colleges, and their leadership from putting forth clear statements of value, right? Like, here right. is what we stand for. And I'm thinking of back in 2016, the Dean of Students at the University of Chicago, John Ellison, put out a very clearly worded statement saying, you know, right. to the then class of 2020, welcome, but here's a place where you're going to be made uncomfortable. There's a free exchange of ideas that is a university priority. We don't support trigger warnings, et cetera. We don't cancel invited speakers. I mean, just really a clear statement of this is what the University of Chicago stands for. I can imagine a similar statement being written today saying we protect all manner of scholarly inquiry, including critical race theory, from the unjust power of the state. But we don't see, are we seeing enough of that?
We're not seeing enough of it. We certainly get examples of it. So my own president at Princeton, Chris Eisgruber, who is a constitutional law scholar before he became president of the university, has issued statements that are very good on exactly these kinds of themes on occasion. As you said, University of Chicago has had leadership that has emphasized these themes. That's been true at Purdue and a variety of other universities as well. Just the other day, the president of Syracuse University issued a very nice statement in response to public criticism of a social media post by a professor on 9/11 that many thought was anti-American in content. And you would hope that university presidents would be better about and more consistent about issuing those kind of statements, trying to educate their own campus community and the larger public on these core principles of what universities are all about. But they're not consistent about it. They're not always very good about it. Syracuse itself, for example, has a very checkered history on this front. So the university was very good in this most recent incident, but there have been incidents in the past where they've been very bad in caving in to these kinds of pressures. It is true that we ought to praise university leaders when they behave well in these circumstances. But regrettably, they don't always behave well.
Well, we've got lots of comments coming in here. Terry Fortman says, cancel culture and blackballing in academia is very worrisome. How can there be academic freedom with such a situation? And Aaron Palicki asks, I would like to know when Mr. Whittington thinks it's justified for students or outsiders to agitate about a faculty member. Just briefly, Professor, is there anything at all that's off limits that Aaron wants to know? Is that thunder?
That is thunder, okay. Sorry. we have a thunderstorm arriving. So you expect hard conversations on college campuses, and students should be part of that. If students have objections to how faculty are teaching classes, to ideas they're expressing, to scholarship they have published, students should feel very free to criticize those. And as professors, we ought to be willing to defend our views. We ought to be willing to explain choices that we make and stand by them. And we also ought to be willing to listen to criticism and sometimes adjust. And we actually have plenty of examples where professors actually listen to criticisms, including from students, and say, you know what, you're right, I should do this differently in the future. Where you really want to draw a line is to say there's a difference between having that conversation, voicing those criticisms, and calling for people to be punished, terminated, sanctioned as a consequence of their speech.
Well, we have a minute here left to go. And I think perhaps the most important question for everyone who's not in a college or university right now is, why is this important? Why should we as a country care about, you know, sort of the hothouse of thought on college campuses?
Well, I would hope the country as a whole gets better as well about tolerating dissent and the free expression of ideas. Universities ought to be leaders on that front. They ought to serve as an example that it's possible to tolerate people who disagree with you and actually engage them constructively. And so it's terrible if universities, instead of being models for that kind of civil discourse, instead become models for cancel culture. Moreover, if universities become places where certain ideas can't be explored constructively and with due diligence, the result is our scholarship will be worse, our education will be worse. We will not actually learn the truth about things. We will not understand the world as well as we should. And society as a whole will be worse off as a consequence because we have the boundaries of human knowledge, which is what universities ought to be doing.
Well, Keith Whittington is the William Nelson Cromwell Professor of Politics at Princeton, author of Speak Freely, Why Universities Must Defend Free Speech, and he's also chair of the Academic Freedom Alliance. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.